Good morning, everyone. Well, we've been planning for some time for our meeting with Barry Britnell. Been looking forward to it. I know we all have, and anxious to hear the lessons that Barry has worked on and prepared for us.
Well, good morning. You're being passed out a handout. I've prepared a couple of handouts that we'll be using over this series of lessons, and hopefully it's something that you can use to help you follow along with what we're talking about. I appreciate so much all of you being here this morning, and I sincerely mean that because the three people that worship here that I have known the longest aren't here today. And so I appreciate those of you who are here. I grew up in Athens, Alabama, and therefore I have known Sandra and her family, the Richter family, my entire life. And when her and Joe contacted me several days ago and told me what was happening with their daughter, she apologize for not being here, and that's perfectly understandable. If I had grandkids, I probably would do the exact same thing. And I have known Rick and Anita Harrington for 25, 30 years. I was actually in their wedding when they got married, and so I have known them a very, very long time as well. And I know they had a previous engagement and couldn't be here today. And so I say all that to say that of the people that I've known the longest, they're not here. So I really am thankful that you are here this morning. And I appreciate you coming out here on a Saturday morning to learn a little bit more about all of this. I want to, I recognize that a lot of you do not know me. And I want to spend just a couple of minutes of introducing myself. As you know, my name is Barry Britnell. I live in Athens, Alabama. I worship at the Capshaw Church of Christ. My wife, Tabitha, is here with me today, and we have three children. My oldest is 21. Okay, glad she's here. 21, Jacob, and he lives down in Tampa. He goes to the University of South Florida. And we have Samuel, who is a junior in high school, and he's here, and Elizabeth Ann, who is in eighth grade. And we actually had a long weekend due to the Veterans Day holiday, and so we decided just to kind of make a weekend of it and come over here. And we are so glad that we did. Let me tell you how I got started with this. Back in 2006, my parents made a trip over to Israel with Farrell Jenkins. And as soon as they got back, they called me on the phone. They said, "Well, Barry, you need to get over there. You need to see this." And we had little kids at the time, and I thought, well, you know, we just can't do it right now. In 2008, my sister and brother-in-law went over there. And again, as soon as they got back, they said, "Wow, you have got to go over there. And we'll keep your kids." And so we were like, okay, well, that's what we needed. And so in 2010, Tabitha and I went over there. We went over there with Farrell Jenkins. I'm sure many of you are at least familiar with his name. He has been leading tours over there since 1968, a very long time, 50 years he's been leading tours over there. Very knowledgeable about the lands of the Bible. And it was a thrill to be able to go over there. And I think the reason they wanted me to go was because they, first of all, they knew how much I love the Bible. I love God's Word. But they also knew how much I loved geography. And they knew that I would really love going over there. And they were right. And if you've spoken to people who have gone over there, a lot of times they'll come back and they'll say, well, it was a life-changing trip. And sometimes that is really true. Sometimes it's a cliche. In my instance, it was extremely true. Since that trip, I have pretty much dedicated my life to learning and teaching more about biblical geography, because I am convinced that if you understand a little bit about geography of Israel and the climate of Israel and some of the culture of Israel, that a lot of things in this Bible will make a lot more sense to you. You'll understand, have a deeper understanding of all that. And that's what we want to talk about tonight. So I went this morning. I'm getting ahead of myself. So I went over there in 2010. Well, I also love to organize things, and I love to travel. And so I have been friends with the Jenkins family my entire life. In fact, the very first Bible class teacher that I can remember was his mother, Vera Jenkins, in Huntsville, Alabama. And so I have known the Jenkins family my entire life. And so between 2010 and 2012, I made two separate trips down to Tampa to talk to him about leading tours, and he patiently answered thousands of questions of mine. And so I began to kind of put that together and actually went back over there with him in 2012. and was able to not only learn more about the lands of the Bible, but also he allowed me to be to kind of shadow him a little bit as he kind of conducted the tour, and he would kind of tell me little things as they happened. And so that allowed me to kind of learn about that. And so I started organizing that. And I led my first tour in 2014. Tabitha and I now lead tours usually about once a year. We led a tour in 2014. We led a tour in 2015. And if you look closely at this picture, you may see four or five people in there you recognize. You'll see Joe and Sandra and Gary and Joyce and myself. In this picture, this was taken from the Mount of Olives, looking across the Kidron Valley at the modern city of Jerusalem. I had not planned on going over to Israel in 2016, but an opportunity arose with some other Christians to go over there and film some videos about the life of Jesus. And we wanted to film those in Israel. And so we went over there in 2016 and filmed some of those videos. And then earlier this year, I've actually made two trips over there. I had a tour in 2017 in June. And I went back over there with this film crew in July. And so over the last 6 or 7 years, I've made 7 trips over there. And Lord willing, I'll be back over there in 2018. And every time I go, I learn more. It's just overwhelming, the amount of information that you can learn over there. And as I said, the more that you learn, the more that you can understand a lot of these Bible stories. And so that's what we're going to try to do this weekend. I'm going to try to present some lessons in which we look at some of the lands a little bit more closely, and perhaps you can make some application. And I want to say, too, that I want to treat the two sessions this morning, as well as the first and third session tomorrow, a little bit more laid back. At the end of these sessions, as time allows, I want to be able to allow you to ask questions. If you have any questions, jot them down or something while we're talking, and I'll be more than happy to answer questions as we have time. And during these sessions, I may ask a question of in the audience, and you should feel free to answer the question. This isn't, I don't see these sessions as being like a sermon, and so I want this to be a little bit more laid back so we can just kind of discuss this and learn something as we go. So let me get started here by answering three questions. And these questions are about Israel, but they're not even biblically based. I'll go ahead and tell you that. But the reason I like to start off by answering these three questions is because anytime I start a series like this, I can see the looks on people's faces. They've got these questions in their mind, but they're just scared to ask them. And so let's just get these three questions out of the way so that we can concentrate on what we want to concentrate on. The first one is, what languages do they speak in Israel today? Well, as you would expect, the Jewish people speak Hebrew. There's a lot of Palestinian Arab people that speak Arabic, and English is pretty widely spoken over there. Mostly that's because of tourism. It's very rare that I don't know a word of Hebrew. I know a couple words of Hebrew. Bokatov means good morning. Shalom, of course, is a kind of a general greeting, and that's pretty much about it of my Hebrew knowledge. I don't know any Arabic, and of course I know English. I'm from Alabama, so that's even debatable to some point. But I really don't have any problems finding people to communicate. A lot of people up there speak English. But Hebrew and Arabic are the two primary languages that you see. And so, as you're driving around, you'll see things like this. This is a gas station. I took this down close to Beersheba. This is a gas station. And as you can see, the Hebrew writing there on the sign. I'll tell you too that if you have any math whizzes in the audience, those prices right there are in shekels per liter. So we do our prices in dollars per gallon. This is in shekels per liter. And so if those of you want to figure out how much they're paying for gas, you can take this and work on it during the night. It's probably not what you'd expect. I'll go ahead and tell you that. But this is a typical sign. This sign is at the theater at Caesarea. We're going to talk about Caesarea in our next hour. But as you can see here, we got the three languages of Hebrew, Arabic, and English all on this sign. This is very typical of street signs over there. Nearly all major street signs have all three languages on them. And so, as I said, it for those of us who don't speak Hebrew or Arabic, it's really no problem navigating around the country. The second question is, what kind of food do they have in Israel? Well, for the most part, good. It's good food. We stay in hotels, and to be honest with you, these hotels really kind of cater to Western tourists. And so I am a fairly picky eater, I'll admit that, but I've really never had any problems finding things to eat over there. At dinner, you'll have beef and lamb and chicken and fish. No pork anywhere in Israel. Pork is against not only Jewish law, but it's also against Islamic law to consume. And so there is no pork in Israel. And in fact, Joe and I, as we were eating sausage this morning, we were talking about it, because I don't realize how much pork I actually eat until I'm in an environment which you can't have pork for like 2 weeks. And usually we'll land back in Huntsville at the airport, and between our house and the airport and our house is a barbecue place, and I usually go through there and get me a sandwich. I got to get that back in my system. And so, but at breakfast, you know, they'll have, you know, pastries and fruit and all kind of breads. At lunch, they'll have things like falafels and shawarma, which is a kind of a barbecue chicken. Both of those are really good. They'll serve you a salad kind of like this. The salad doesn't come all together. They'll put it out in little bowls on the plate, on the table, and you kind of assemble it yourself. A lot of those salads are actually stuffed down in a piece of pita bread, and you'll eat it that way. And so they have a lot of foods that may be a little bit different, but they're very delicious. They do have a lot of things that are similar to what we have over here. And then they have a few things that are actually really similar to what we have over here. And the interesting thing about some of these, in fact, here's McDonald's, here's a menu of what it looks like in the McDonald's. And if you look closely, you'll notice that you can purchase hamburgers there, but you can't purchase cheeseburgers, because it's against Jewish law to mix dairy and meat in the same dish. And so you can buy hamburgers over there, but you can't buy cheeseburgers. And unfortunately for me, I really like meat pizzas. Like, if you go to Pizza Hut and get a meat lover or something like that, I really like meat pizzas, and you can't get that over there. You can't get meat on a pizza with cheese on it. But I will say that when you make your own dough and you make your own tomato sauce and you make your own cheese, you can make a really, really good pizza if you do that. And so it's really good. The third question that I get is this: is it safe to travel in Israel? And I get this question a lot. You know, from a person who kind of leads tours, I get this question a lot. And I'll have to admit, sometimes I have to kind of bite my tongue a little bit and not give kind of a sarcastic answer, because there's almost an implication in this question that I would actually purposefully take people over to Israel knowing that it was dangerous. And that's not the case at all. To be honest with you, most parts of Israel I feel are much safer to travel in than a lot of parts of the United States. But I know why people ask this question. And the people ask this question because they've seen scenes like this. The news only reports things that they feel like they can get ratings for. And so if they have some sort of problem over in Israel, that's what they'll report. And they'll show scenes such as this of skirmishes going on. Most of the time when they have skirmishes like this, it's not even anything Jewish versus Arab. Most of the time it's Arab versus Arab. The government is not paying the employees enough or something like that, and so they're rioting against the government. But when you see scenes like this, that gives you a sense of pause to think, oh, it's dangerous over there. And generally, the Middle East, if you just say, I'm going to travel to the Middle East, that puts maybe kind of fear in people. But the truth of the matter is that most parts of the Middle East are very safe to travel. And that's especially true in Israel. Israel, the news agencies over here report only bad news. And that's not just a U.S. problem. That's the same problem over in over in Israel. When we were over there in 2016, we were over there at the same time that they had the shooting tragedy at the nightclub in Orlando here. And if you were to watch Israeli news, which we did, you would think that was happening all over the United States. And of course, those of us who live here in the United States know that was just an isolated event. As terrible as it was just an isolated event. And the same thing happens over there. What the news over here in the United States don't tell you is they don't tell you about how many people over there pray. There's a lot of Muslim over there, and although I disagree with them, obviously, on a lot of religious things, I have to admire their loyalty to prayer. And that same holds true for Jewish people. I took this picture one morning, probably about 7 o'clock in the morning at the Western Wall, and what you see there are young boys praying. And why are they there? Well, they're there because this is part of their formal education. Every morning, before you learn to read and write and do arithmetic, you learn how to pray. And I may disagree with the Jewish people on some of their religion, but listen, there's something I can learn from that as a parent. That what's more important than reading and writing, and that's learning how to pray. And so you see things like this all the time over there. The news also doesn't report about the beautiful sunrises. We live in Athens. We have a house that faces east. Across the road, there's this cotton field. And let me tell you, this time of year, in October, October was last month, when the cotton field is white and that sun comes up, it is absolutely beautiful. But I tell you what's even almost more beautiful is the sun rising over the Sea of Galilee. Absolutely stunning every morning. It's just fantastic. And that's something the news doesn't show you. The news doesn't talk about the bumper wheat harvest over there. I took this picture on the eastern end of the Jezreel Valley. Beautiful, beautiful wheat over there. The news doesn't tell you about the opening of ski season on Mount Hermon. Mount Hermon is over 9,000 feet in elevation. I think this is the probable location of the transfiguration of Jesus here on the top of Mount Hermon. They have a huge ski resort there. That's things that you don't hear about in the news. But the answer to that question is yes, it's extremely safe to travel in Israel. You know, the folks here in the audience can attest, and they can back me up on this. But usually, throughout the trip, everybody on the tour will come up at some point and say, "Wow, Barry, this isn't anything like what it is on the news." And I say, "Yeah, I know." And it's kind of sad. You kind of have to kind of work through it just to realize how safe it is. But that's three questions that I generally get asked kind of as a blanket. And as I said, those aren't really biblically related. People just are curious about them. But let's turn our attention to the topic for this session. And as I said, what I want to do is teach this, and then we want to take a little bit of a break before the 11 o'clock session. And so we'll just kind of judge the time as we go. But I want to stress in this lesson that I think if you understand parts of the geography of Israel and the climate, that so many stories will mean much more to you. Let's just talk about that just for a few minutes. What do we know about the land of Israel? It's very small. And we don't really realize how small it is until you actually get over there. But during the time of the Bible, most people who lived on the world lived within the confines of this map. Not everyone, but most people did. And what you have here is the conjunction of three different continents. Europe, up in the upper left, Asia in the upper right, and then Africa down here to the bottom. God made a promise to Abraham. He said, "I'm going to give your people a land." Now, God is God. He could have given them any land He wanted to. Why did He choose this piece of land right here? Why did He choose this tiny, tiny, little bitty piece of land? Well, I don't know. I'm not God. There's some things that God does that I don't actually understand 100%. I don't know, but we can guess about that a little bit. If you look at this little piece of land here, on the left side, on the western side, what you have is the Mediterranean Sea. During the times of the Bible, there were boats and ships going across the Mediterranean Sea, but they didn't carry large groups of people. These were mostly shipping and things like that. To the east of this little area, it's all desert. And so what you have within the confines of that little oval there is a 40-mile-wide piece of land that is completely agriculture. People can live there. There's water. It's a wonderful, wonderful place to live. But during the time of the Bible, whoever lived there controlled passage between these three continents. The only way to go from one continent to another is to go through this piece of land. So why did God put His people there? Well, it could be so that the knowledge of God would spread throughout the whole known world. People could come through here and they'd say, wow, look, these people are blessed. Why are these people so blessed? And that would give the Israelites the opportunity to say, well, let me tell you, our God has provided this for us. And then the God of the Israelites could be spread throughout the known world. And of course, if you understand the importance of this tiny piece of land, then you really can take even a closer look and understand the importance of a lot of the roads and the cities. Cities like Lachish and Gezer and Megiddo and Hazor. Why those cities were so strategically important? Because if you controlled those cities, you controlled the passageway through this little narrow piece of land. And if you controlled the passageway through that narrow piece of land, you controlled the passageway throughout this entire section of the world. It was very, very important. But as I said, this is a tiny, tiny piece of land. And if you understand how small it is, you'll be amazed at how geographically diverse it is. Let's look at this from a geographical perspective. Starting with the Mediterranean Sea, you come in and you have the coastal plain. This is fairly flat. It's about 10 to 12 miles wide. And think about that for a second. I just said the phrase 10 to 12 miles. But think of a city or a location that's 10 to 12 miles from here. It's not that far. This is a very small piece of land. Coastal plain is very flat. A lot of times we associate the coastal plain with this is where, especially in the southern part, this is where the Philistines lived during the time of the United Kingdom. They lived out in the plain. Coming on to the farther to the east, what you see there in green is the hill country. Now the coastal plain, very, very flat. The hill country, lots of hills and valleys. Many of the cities throughout the hill country are around 3,000 feet in elevation. These would be cities like Hebron, Bethlehem, Jerusalem, Shiloh, and then even up into Nazareth, up into Galilee. Coming to east of that, what you have is the Jordan Rift Valley. Now, just as the hill country was hilly, this is extremely flat, but it's also very low. Nearly this entire area that you see here highlighted in red is below sea level. It's below the level of the Mediterranean Sea. And of course, the places in here, in this area, are the Sea of Galilee. The Sea of Galilee is about 750 feet below sea level. The Jordan River, between the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea. And of course, the Dead Sea, which is nearly 1,350 feet below sea level, is the lowest place on the face of the earth. Coming to the east, what you have is the Transjordan Plateau. When you go just from the Jordan Rift Valley, you go directly up a couple thousand feet, and then it flattens off across into the desert. This is the area that we now call the Kingdom of Jordan, where the country of Jordan is. It's in this area. Now, if you look closely, those of you who are looking closely at this, you may have noticed there's a couple places that I skipped. There are a couple of oddities to these four general areas. One of them is the Jezreel Valley in the yellow area. And now that you understand a little bit about the hill country, you'll understand how important the Jezreel Valley is. The Jezreel Valley is, for the most part, flat, but it allows east-west passage through the land. Megiddo sits on the southern side of the Jezreel Valley. Therefore, if you understand how much traffic goes there, you understand the importance of Megiddo. Megiddo has been destroyed and rebuilt over 20 times in its history. In fact, there was a Pharaoh Thutmose III, that said capturing Megiddo was like capturing 1,000 cities. And now you know why. It's because if you controlled that city, you controlled all passage north, south, and east, west throughout this land. Very, very important city. Down there toward the bottom, there's another little area in light green there called the Shephelah. Shephelah is a Hebrew word, but you'll probably see it on your maps. That word is translated in our English Bibles as the word lowlands. And tomorrow morning's first session, we'll talk about a passage that has that word in it. But during the time of the United Kingdom, the lowlands separated the coastal plain from the hill country. And so that became a battleground. The famous battle between David and Goliath took place in the Elah Valley. The Elah Valley is one of five east-west valleys through the Shephelah. And so it's a very, very important piece of land as well. But that is the land of Israel, divided up into the geographical areas. Now, I want you to do a little mental exercise with me. I want you to, let's take this land, and I want us to divide it. We're just going to take a line and draw right across it, and we're going to cut the land in half and then lay it on its back and look at the elevation of that. And if you do, it'll look something like this. What you have is the coastal plain over on the left, very flat, rising up into the hill country, dipping down into the Jordan Rift Valley, then before it rises again on the Transjordan Plateau. Now, a little moment of tell you something about me. Tabitha and I had met back in 1989, 1990, when we were both students at Florida State University, and we were both meteorology students. So we have two meteorologists in the same family. So we sit around most of the time and just watch the Weather Channel, because that's what we do. And but any chance we get to talk about weather, we're going to talk about weather. And so I've already had two or three people tell me about what a nice day it is outside. Absolutely, love it. I love it. You know, for a weatherman, there is no thing as good weather and bad weather. It's just different types of weather. And so it could be sleeting out there, and Tabitha and I would be saying, boy, look at that. That's great weather out there. That's fantastic. But we're going to talk about the weather just for a second. Most of the year, winds blow off the Mediterranean Sea, and when you get warm, moist air coming across the sea, and that what happens is that those water droplets that are in the air rise when they get to the mountains, and they condense, and clouds form. And when clouds form, of course, when the clouds get big enough, the rain droplets get big enough, they fall as rain. So the hill country gets a lot of rain. We'll talk about that specifically in just a moment, but it gets a lot of rain. As the winds continue to blow, those winds go down into the Jordan Rift Valley, and when they do, the air warms, the clouds dissipate, and so down there in the valley, they don't get very much rain at all. So that leads to some extremely interesting weather phenomena. For instance, as I mentioned, Jerusalem sits at the very top of the hill country, about 2,700 feet in elevation. And it has an annual rainfall of 26 inches. Now, how does that compare to some other place on earth, 26 inches? Well, you know, London, it rains all the time in London. All the time. In fact, put on your Disney hat for a second. When Mary Poppins showed up at the Banks house in London, she had two things with her. And what were they? Yeah, a carpet bag and an umbrella. Why does she need the umbrella? It's because it always rains in London. And it does. But London only gets about 28 inches of rain per year. Jerusalem gets almost as much rain as London does. But with London, it kind of rains lightly all year. And so that's why it kind of seems like it's always raining in London, because it always is. But Jerusalem has just about as much rain as London does. But keeping in mind what I said a minute ago about the way the clouds and everything works, I want you to look at this. Jericho sits down in the bottom of the Jordan Rift Valley. It sits 850 feet below sea level. It is only, as the crow flies, only about 12 miles from Jerusalem. But look at their rainfall. 5 to 6 inches per rain per year. They have Jerusalem has over five times as much rain as Jericho does, and they're only separated by about 12 miles. So think about that. Think of a place that's about 12 miles away from here, and imagine if you got five times as much rain as they did. And that's the situation you have here. And so it's incredibly different. Jericho sits about 3,500 feet in elevation, lower than Jerusalem. And for those of us who have been over there, you know that when you're riding that bus from Jericho up to Jerusalem, your ears are popping because you're gaining elevation fast going up that hill. And so you have, even though these two cities are only 12 miles apart, they have drastically different weather. Drastically different weather. And that's just one of the many different phenomena that you have over there. So, with all that in your mind, I want us to take a look at 1 Samuel, the 12th chapter. There's an extremely interesting story here that if you know a little bit about geography and what we've just talked about is just a beautiful point to be made here. Let me set this up. The Israelites are having a problem with the Ammonites. And so they go up to a place called Jabesh-Gilead, which is on the eastern side of the Jordan River, and they battle the Ammonites there. Saul is their king. They've gone up there. They defeat the Ammonites. And now they have come back to, they're coming back home, and they stop in a place called Gilgal. Now, Gilgal was not a fortified city like Jericho was. And so we don't know exactly where Gilgal is. There's no ruins left of that city like there are, for instance, of Jericho. But it was very close to Jericho, probably within a mile or so of Jericho, down in the bottom of the Jordan Rift Valley. And so they've come back here to Gilgal, and Samuel, who is getting very old, wants to say something to him. You know, when you, especially if you get close to dying, you've got things that you want to say to people. And that's exactly the situation that Samuel is in right here. And so Samuel gathers all the people together, and they're at Gilgal. And so he begins talking to them. So I just want to read 1 Samuel 12. Let's read a few verses, and then I'll make a few comments. In 1 Samuel 12, beginning in verse 1, it says, "And Samuel said to all of Israel, 'Behold, I have obeyed your voice in all that you have said to me, and have made a king over you. And now, behold, the king walks before you. I am old and gray, and behold, my sons are with you. I have walked before you from my youth until this day. Here I am. Testify against me before the Lord and before his anointed. Whose ox have I taken? Whose donkey have I taken? Of whom have I defrauded? Whom have I oppressed? Or from whose hand have I taken a bribe to blind the eyes that are with it? Testify against me, and I will restore it to you.' They said, 'You have not defrauded us, or oppressed us, or taken anything from any man's hand.' And he said to them, 'The Lord is witness against you, and his anointed is witness against this day. Did you have not found anything in my hand?' And they said, 'He is witness.'" So, summing up the first five verses, Samuel says, "I have something I want to tell you. But before I do, I need to make sure that you're going to listen to me. And I want to make sure that none of you have anything against me, because I want you to really comprehend what I'm about to tell you." And they said, "No, everything is good here. As a witness to God, we say that you have nothing, you've done nothing to us." So, look in verse 6. "And Samuel said to the people, 'The Lord is witness, who appointed Moses and Aaron and brought your fathers up out of the land of Egypt. Now therefore stand still, that I may plead with you before the Lord concerning all the righteous deeds of the Lord that he performed for you and for your fathers. When Jacob went into Egypt and the Egyptians oppressed them, then your fathers cried out to the Lord, and the Lord sent Moses and Aaron and brought your fathers out of Egypt and made them dwell in this place. But they forgot the Lord their God, and he sold them into the hand of Sisera, commander of the army of Hazor, and into the hand of the Philistines, and into the hand of the king of Moab. And they fought against them. And they cried out to the Lord and said, 'We have sinned because we have forsaken the Lord and have served the Baals and Ashtaroth. But now deliver us from the hand of your enemies that we may serve you.' And the Lord sent Jerubbabel and Barak and Jephthah and Samuel and delivered you out of the hand of your enemies on every side, and you lived in safety." So he gives them a little history lesson. He says, "Do you remember back in Egypt? And you remember how God took care of you? Remember how the people came out of Egypt and God took care of them? And you remember how when you came here, you ran into trouble? Guess what? God took care of you." He reminds them all the times that God has taken care of them throughout the history of the people. Let's keep reading. Verse 12. "And when you saw that Nahash, the king of the Ammonites, came to you, you said to me, 'No, but a king shall reign over us, when the Lord your God was your king. And now behold the king whom you have chosen, for whom you have asked. Behold, the Lord has set a king over you. If you will fear the Lord and serve him and obey his voice and will not rebel against the commandment of the Lord, and if both of you and the king who reigns over you will follow the Lord your God, it will be well. But if you will not obey the voice of the Lord, but rebel against the commandment of the Lord, then the hand of the Lord will be against you and your king.'" So what he says here is, listen, despite what I told you a minute ago about how much God has helped you. Every time you needed help, God was there for you. Despite that, you still asked for a king. And guess what? God heard you again, and He gave you a king. Despite the fact that you've kind of mentally rejected God and asked for a physical king, God's still going to be with you. If you do good and your king does good, God is going to bless you. But of course, if you don't, then He will not bless you. So, let's keep reading. In verse 16, Samuel concludes by saying, "Now therefore stand still and see the great thing that the Lord will do before your eyes. Is it not the wheat harvest today? I will call upon the Lord that He may send thunder and rain, and you shall know and see that your wickedness is great, which you have done in the sight of the Lord, in asking for yourselves a king." So Samuel called upon the Lord, and the Lord sent thunder and rain that day, and all the people greatly feared the Lord and Samuel. So before the people, Samuel, with the Lord's help, calls for thunder and rain to come down on the people. And so we ask the question, why did the people react the way they did? Why did they react the way they did? It said that they greatly feared the Lord and Samuel. Why did this have such a profound effect on them? I can think of three reasons. First of all, God had caused thunder and rain. Remember, these are people that aren't at their homes. They had been away at war. They're on their way back to homes. They've kind of set up a temporary camp here as they're on their way back. God had made it thunder and rain. And you know what it's like when you're outside and it starts thunder and raining? You get nervous. I do. So the fact that they had made it thunder and rain was a powerful sign to them. Second reason why they reacted this way, God had made it thunder and rain in a place where it rarely rains. Remember what we learned a few minutes ago about Gilgal and where it's located next to Jericho? It rarely rains in this place. They have 4 to 5 inches of rain per year. Yet, just like that, God had made it rain right there at Gilgal. That had an effect on them. That made an impression on them. What about the third thing? Well, before I can tell you the third thing, I need to tell you a little bit more about the climate. Did you notice that Samuel asked an extremely odd question in the midst of his message to the people? He asked the question, "Is it not the wheat harvest today?" Now, why in the world would that make any difference at all to what he's saying? Yet Samuel said that. Let's talk about that. I mentioned that Jerusalem gets about 24 inches of rain, 25 inches of rain per year. And I mentioned that London gets a little bit more rain than that, but basically the same amount of rain, but it rains all year. This is I'm really going to show you how geeky and, I mean, I there's no denying it. I'm kind of a geek. But here's a chart, and on the bottom of the chart, what you have are the months of the year, January, February, March, April, May, on through December. And up on the left, what you have are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. This is inches of rain. Now, the Bible tells us that when the people moved into the land, that God said He would send them rain. He would send them the early rains and the latter rains. Well, this is the way the rain falls in Jerusalem every year. The early rains start in October, and it rains almost continually, November, December, January, February, March, and then it starts to tail off in April. The early rains are in October. The latter rains are in March to April every year. First tour that I led, it was in June of 2014. People asked me, "What do we need to take as far as rain gear?" And I said, "Nothing." And they said, "Are you saying that because you're a smart aleck weather guy?" And I said, "Well, possibly. But no, I'm saying that because it doesn't rain in Israel in June. It hasn't rained in Israel in June in 3,000 years, and I doubt it's going to this year." So that's the way the rain falls in Jerusalem. Now, but we're located at Jericho. As you'd expect, Jericho is the same distribution, just much less amounts. But as you can see, it starts raining, even though it's just a little bit, in October, and then it rains until April. So let's think about Samuel's question. Is it not the wheat harvest today? When is the wheat harvest? It's in June. That's why he asked that question. Why did this event have such an effect on the people? Three reasons. One, God had made it thunder and rain. Second, God had made it thunder and rain at a place where it rarely rains. Third, God had made it thunder and rain at a place where it rarely rains at a time of year in which it never rains. And the people feared the Lord and Samuel because of that. And I think this story is a perfect example of what having a little knowledge of the geography and the climate of Israel can affect your understanding of a story. We have a little kids' class at where we worship. Sometimes they'll sing the song, "My God is so big, so strong and so mighty. There's nothing my God cannot do. My God can make it rain." That's my lesson for this hour.